Blog Talk Radio.
Accountable Care on the Blog Talk Radio and Affiliate Networks is brought to you by National ACO. National ACO, one of 44 participants admitted as a next generation model accountable care organization by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, is experiencing strong growth, was nation leading in its first performance year, and has logged 5 years of successful operations. National ACO is leading innovation in value-based healthcare, alternative payment models, and population health management. Welcome, everyone. I'm Greg Masters, your producer and moderator, known to some on Twitter as @2HealthGuru, and the publisher of ACOWatch.com. I'm joined in the virtual studio by National ACO co-founders Dr. Andre Berger, Chief Executive Officer, and Dr. Alex Foxman, President and Chief Medical Officer, respectively. And now for today's special guest, Dr. Farzad Mostashari. Farzad Mostashari, MD, is CEO of Allidaid, a startup he co-founded aimed at helping primary care physicians form accountable care organizations. He previously served as both deputy and national coordinator of health IT at the Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology, where he coordinated U.S. efforts to build a health information technology infrastructure for healthcare reform and consumer empowerment. A fellow at Brookings Institution and assistant commissioner for the Primary Care Information Project at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, Allidaid partners with 205 primary care physician practices, federally qualified health centers, and regional health cooperatives in value-based healthcare, organized into 16 accountable care organizations across 15 states. These primary care physicians are accountable for more than 190,000 Medicare beneficiaries. More than half of Allidaid's primary care physicians are in practices with fewer than 10 clinicians. Allidaid is committed to outcome-based approaches to determine the value of healthcare. The company is committed to using technology, data, practice transformation expertise, and most importantly, the relationship between a person and their primary care physician to improve the value of healthcare. So with that introduction, Drs. Berger and Foxman, over to you. Help us get to know Dr. Mostashari, his work at Allidaid, and current take on the state of the accountable care industry.
Well, that was a mouthful of an introduction because Farzad, you have done so many great things, and we're very honored to have you with us today as somebody that I think can add a lot of great insight into the current state of affairs in the transition from volume to value, as well as kind of what you see the kind of the future in your crystal ball, and we'd like to pick your brain on some of these things. But having said that, I think one of the things I want to start with is the idea of, like, what's different today. We now have a kind of a transformation going on in the marketplace, this idea of volume to value. It started off maybe in the 90s, and it's kind of evolved a little bit here and there. And we've had all these different bifurcations and acronyms associated with these bifurcations, IPAs, PHOs, MSOs, EIEIOs, all kinds of these organizations that have developed. So the question, you know, for me to ask you, what is your vision? What's Allidaid? Is it a new one, an old PPMC bottle, or have we finally settled in on a model, your vision, that can actually deliver on the triple aim, you know, the better care, better outcomes, and lower per capita costs? help us understand what your thoughts are.
Yeah, well, I was in med school in the 90s, so I can't speak exactly to what the similarities, differences. But here's some things that I think from what I've read might be a little bit different this time around. You know, there's basically three pillars to what we do and what others are doing in this new movement, right? There's the contracting side, so we help practices obtain value-based contracts from public and private payers, Medicare Advantage, Medicaid, Medicare Shared Savings Program, and so forth. There's a second part, which is technology and data, and then there's a third part, which is practice transformation. So on each of those, I think that things are a little different than what, and we've learned something, and things are a little bit, I think, more hopeful that we're not going to see the pendulum swing back again towards fee-for-service. On the contracting side, I do think that we're seeing some learnings and some smarter contracting where quality really matters, and we're seeing both it spread beyond just Medicare to commercial payers. And the idea that the backlash that came last time, where deserved or not, the patients felt like they were not getting more, that I think has changed now. And the second related to that is we have much more tools now to actually be able to analyze networks and do predictive modeling and figure out who's the high-risk patients and who's at highest risk of being readmitted, and have real-time event notifications, to have electronic health records with decision support. None of that was in place even 10 years ago. So, and, you know, for that, I do think we do need to appreciate the infrastructure that's been built on health IT the past 10 years, and I'm proud to have been a part of that. But now it's time to put it to purpose. And that brings us to the third piece of this, which is the eternal challenge of how do we actually change workflows? How do we actually transform the experience of a patient and providers in taking care of that in that encounter, and rewiring the practice, as it were, to perform differently? So I do think that we have better contract forms that provide fewer conflicts between what's best for the patient, what's best for the provider, and what's best for society. That alignment is the key, right, that runs through everything we're trying to do. Let's make sure that whatever the policies are established are good for patients. It's what you would want for your mom. They're good for the doctors. It's sustainable for them, and it's good for society, sustainable for society. So that's part one. Part two is absolutely the technology. Even 5 years ago, I don't think we could have done this the same way that we're able to scale through cloud-based tools and the analytics that we're doing and the data sharing that we're seeing. So that's the second part. But the third part is in some ways the most important, that's never going to change, which is the will to and the engagement of clinicians in this. And I like to say, you know, if we just had engaged clinicians on what we're trying to do, we wouldn't need anything else. We'd be all set.
So I agree with that third part, and that actually brings me to one of my fascinating things about you as well, is how you got to where you are right now. I've read up on some of your history. You've been a part of the New York as assistant commissioner to health. You've done a lot of great things. What makes your story and some of the other ones, such as mine and Dr. Berger, so unique, and why did we become kind of the ones that are riding the beginning wave, and how could we basically emulate what we feel and how we see the future of healthcare into the physicians that we're trying to transform from volume to value-based care?
Yeah, and, you know, everyone has their story that as you're living it doesn't necessarily, you can't figure out how, you know, things seem to happen by chance in our lives, and we look back and it seems like everything was perfectly designed to keep, to end us up where we are right this moment doing exactly what we're doing. And I certainly feel that way, whether it was, you know, training in public health and population health back in the 90s before med school, actually, whether it was kind of my early exposure to computers and statistical methods and epidemiology and then in electronic health records and then my experience with policy at the federal level as a regulator as someone pushing out programs to help stand, you know, shoulder to shoulder with small practices, helping them implement new technologies and new workflows, the health information exchanges, the Beacon communities, all those, and then my experience at Brookings seemed to perfectly kind of put me in a position where I had no choice. I felt like than to begin this work and to really engage in this different kind of service. I've had, you know, public service, civil service. I've been in academic settings and so forth. But this seems very familiar to me in a way. This service to a cause and service to a group of primary care, private practice, independent physicians who all too often are ignored or you know, marginalized in today's healthcare system, and they're kings, and they're treated like pawns, and we're going to change that.
Well said, absolutely.
Farzad, thanks for that. So in your quest, on your mission here, could you help us understand the Adelaide business model?
Yeah.
You know, how you got to come to choose that model. And you've been at this for, you know, a few years. How has it evolved since you launched it, and how have your results to date, and how do you see it evolving in the next few years as you try to continue to create transformation?
Yeah. So we wanted to really keep our business model simple and aligned. So what we said was, look, primary care providers don't have a lot of capital to be able to do all the things that it's going to take. You know, people estimate it takes $2 million plus to start an ACO and to run it every year. So, and oftentimes these ACOs are operating not at scale. So it's not efficient to have every ACO hiring their own analytics people and their own technology people, their own IT people, their own policy people, their own, clinical folks. So the idea here really was to provide at scale services to a larger and larger number of physician groups, networks across the country, and make the price of entry low so that we charge a $1 PM per member per month for their attributed patients in the ACO. So, you know, a practice typically we'll pay less than $1,000 a month, which, you know, isn't nothing, right, for a primary care practice, isn't nothing, and that commitment actually is important. But then we say, look, we're going to get paid when you get paid, if you get paid. We think it's when you get paid, which is when we get savings distributions. And whatever comes back to the ACO, right off the top, 60% goes to the doc pool and gets distributed among the physicians, and 40% comes to Allidaid for our investments, for our growth, for our infrastructure, and so forth. So that's the business model, pure and simple. And, you know, it takes away a lot of the uncertainty and a lot of the upfront cost from the practices, which is why I think we're growing briskly. The statistics you mentioned, we already this year added another 60 practices, 352 providers and 55,000 Medicare lives. So we're now close to having $3 billion under management in 3 years. So the model is growing, and what's gratifying is that it's not just the number of lives or practices, but we are getting better at it. We are deploying faster. We're launching faster. We have more tools in the toolkit year after year after year, and we're seeing great consistency among all of our ACOs in terms of our ability to have reproducible impact on reducing readmissions, on hospital discharges, on some of the big, you know, ticket items, skilled nursing facility discharges, ER visits, all of the utilization data that CMS reports. In literally every single ACO, we're seeing declines in inappropriate and harmful utilization. And we're seeing on the cost side, we're seeing, it takes a while for utilization to translate into costs, and those cost advantages compound over time. Look, I don't want to I do think that our the policies aren't perfect. We got to acknowledge that the benchmarks are not the right counterfactual of what, you know, what the cost would have been, because they don't account for regional trends and recent regional benchmarks. So, you know, our ACOs that had a little bit of a tailwind are going to be more likely to get savings in the first years. Our ACOs that have a little bit of a headwind in that artificial benchmark are going to take a little bit longer. But everyone's moving in the right direction, and we're in this for the long haul, and we're super confident in the business model.
So because Olidade gets paid when a physician or an ACO gets paid, how do you deal with those groups, organizations, or maybe even individual physicians within an organization that just don't get it at this point, that may not get it, that are not aligned, that are not forward-thinking? How does your organization deal with that? Because I think it's something that is sometimes systemic in every organization.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. You know, because our incentives are around outcomes, we don't accept every practice. You know, if you're in a IPA model where you want to go negotiate rates with a payer, then you want to have as many practices as you can, no matter their quality, right? You just want more market power. That's not what we do. We say we actually want the right practices, and we spend a fair bit of time qualifying the practices, both through data as well as through, you know, visiting them and talking to people who've worked with them before. You know, I was just in the launch of our ACO in New Jersey, and you could tell that the practices were impressed with who else was around that table, right? That idea that we're all in this boat together. How am I in a boat with some pretty strong players here? I got to up my game, right? So that, I think, is a really big difference between fee-for-service models where it's just market power versus outcome-based models where it matters who's in your boat, right? Look, every year there are, you know, it's less than 10% of the practices, but there are some practices where the rest, and this is all up to the board, right? This is a physician-governed board who we show every month the data for everybody. And we're like, okay, we said we would do wellness visits. How are we doing? We said we would do transitional care visits. How are we doing? We said we would do care management on the highest cost patients. How are we doing? We show the practices how they're doing. And if someone's always at the bottom, then the question is pretty obvious. Why are you here, right? And so we do see some practices leaving. That's okay. But by far what we see is very, very low rates of churn because the practices really can see the progress they're making.
So right now, aside from the transformation from volume to value, there's another transformation. And that transformation is a transformation into risk, into kind of pushing providers into really the requirement to take on some risk,
mm-hmm.
either directly or indirectly through their ACOs.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your plan for that?
Yeah.
How are you going to move the organizations that you work with into pretty well mandated risk environment over the next several years? What's your thought on that?
We're looking forward to it. and I'd love to hear your experience with the NextGen program as well. Look, I think that the more capable the practices get and the more confident we feel in our ability to manage the cost, the more it makes sense to have more gains. And why are we only getting 50% of the gains that we create? Well, in our two ACOs that are now in their second contract period, we're going into track three where we could get up to 75% of the gains. So I think that's a trade-off that is well worth doing when you're ready, when the practices are ready. Now, it also has to be right-sized. I actually think that we advocated very hard for Track 1 Plus and the formulation of the risk, downside risk, being based on practice revenue. And we now have some of our commercial contracts following that, where the upside is on total cost of care, the downside is on the aggregate practice revenue received. That, to me, is a smarter way of titrating risk so it's not bankrupting for the practices. Even so, I think we have the capital to be able to shield our practices from nearly all of the downside, but not all of it. And I do think that there is some degree of downside risk that is motivating. Too much is paralyzing. Just the right amount can be motivating for everybody in the system, but not so much that that you know providers feel that they can't handle the risk, or policymakers or the public might be afraid that that physicians might do things that are not in the patient's best interest if they're on the downside hook for it. So I think those are important considerations, but we're not afraid of going into a risk environment. In fact, we are now working on a fully capitated Medicare Advantage deal where we get a percent of MLR, but it's got to be in the right place with the right group of docs.
Yeah, I think it's pretty evident through the government's just movement through healthcare and where we're going with risk that it's that and especially looking at macro with MIPS and an alternative payment model that at least Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services wants us to be in full rate in some sort of very high risk based models because they believe that this is really where the savings is. This is where we're fully aligned. And recently, the Next Generation ACO program year 2016 cohort data just came out. There are 18 in the cohort, 11 winners making shared savings, 7 losers. The winners making approximately $58 million in shared savings, the losers approximately $20 million. So this shows about a 64% shared savings rate compared to, you know, what is it now, maybe 35% or so in any year for the MSSP. So the question for you, Farzad, is, because this model, at least in the first cohort, seems to have a advantageous shared savings rate, has a lot of these benefit enhancements that seem to be quite impressive and other means of revenue, why aren't more people gravitating towards this type of model as opposed to staying in a track 2 or 3 or even staying in 1.5?
Yeah, we actually wrote up a whole article about why we chose not to do next gen. and you're right. There are a lot of things about the next gen ACO model that were very, very creative and forward thinking and very useful. But for us, it came down to the benchmark, and the benchmarks are really right. They're based on many years ago what the costs were at that point in time, and if you're an ACO that has, you know, improved costs. If that was not a particularly good benchmark year for you, then that makes it that static benchmark year makes it not a great choice for us compared to track three. But that's something I expect that if the program is given time to iterate, you know, we'll be updated and we look forward to that as really as a lead in to taking on the more significant sorts of Medicare Advantage like arrangements over time.
Farzad, you know, I'm listening to you in terms of the decision point and why there's a decision perhaps not to do this. If you're, for example, if you got $3.2 billion in spend, Medicare spend over all of these physician groups, and you'd have to put up a 2% performance bond on $3.2 billion. That's not an insignificant amount of capital.
Well,
right,
that's partly partly why we've raised $80 million from
right.
From venture capital.
Right. So I'm just saying, you know, do you think that particular, I mean, if you look at, if you really look carefully at the cohort that we know, you know, I think all but three are either IDSs or PHOs. The other three that are physician kind of driven or whatever. One is kind of management company controlled, and the other is very, you know, local to one state.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's national ACO, which happens to be a bit unique because we're physician-owned, governed, and we're multi-state.
Hooray!
Yay!
Hooray!
But, you know, to me, that's the challenge for us. When I say us, I mean we're both physician, you know, we're both in the hooray. We're both physician-driven, physician-governed, physician-owned. We want to stay that way. We kind of have a very similar mission in terms of, you know, what we want to do to promote the right change for the right reasons. But the question I'm asking you is, you know, that's a daunting amount of financial underwriting that has to happen. And for physicians to do that, whether they're organized or not organized, is, you know, Herculean and probably a risk that cannot be swallowed. So where do you see that as far as evolving down the line?
Yeah, I think that two things. One, there have to be lower risk pathways, and that's why I liked the Track 1 Plus, which is an advanced alternative payment model. You practice during the 5% bonus under MACRA. But the downside is as a portion of practice revenue, like 8% of practice revenue from Medicare. So that's good. And the cash reserve requirements are subsequently much lower, much, much, much lower than it would be under Track 3. So that's one answer. The other is I do think that there's a role for organizations like ours and yours to help enable these physician groups to come together in networks and to take risk and to provide them with some of the financial backing and other things like technology and regulatory that they will need to succeed. So I think you can continue to be independent, but you can't be atomic anymore.
So with a couple of minutes left, we only have 3 minutes left, this is where, Farzad, you take out your wizard hat and your crystal ball, and you tell us where you think we're going to be in the next 3, 5, 10 years in healthcare. How's this all going to come together? Are we going to be looking at the same type of models, or what do you think will be happening now and in the future?
Well, one thing, I do think the data is going to continue to show that physician-led ACOs are going to do better than health system-based ACOs. The data is pretty clear on that. I think that gap is going to continue to widen, and I think the consequence of that from a policy point of view is more attention to consolidation, antitrust, making sure that anti-competitive behavior isn't tolerated, things like facility fees and site-neutral payments and 340B that are driving independent practice to join health systems are going to be looked at. That's one. Two, I do think that there is more, as you pointed out, and I think the same is true for Track 2 and 3, that ACOs that do take more risk are more successful, so I see that trend continuing, and Medicare Advantage really being the final destination for many.
Well, Farzad, I want to thank you so much for the great insight and really some of your smart thoughts. We share your vision. We wish you the greatest success with your business plan and your future, and we hope that you'll indulge us and come back again.
Of course.
So we can further this discussion. And again, thank you so much.
Yeah.
We appreciate it.
And continue to nurture community-based healthcare around the nation. That's of utmost importance.
Amen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
There you have it. That's an amen. That'll be the last word for today's broadcast. I do want to thank our guest, Dr. Farzad Mostashari, the co-founder and CEO at Aledade, for his time and insights today. Stay current with Aledade's work on Twitter via @Aledade. That's Aledade ACO. and on the web via www.aliday.com. Finally, do follow National ACO on the web via www.nacomso.com and on Twitter via the same NACOMSO. Our next broadcast, October 31st, we chat with former Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services Acting Administrator Andy Slavitt, who's been a relentless warrior advocating for a bipartisan solution to support the Affordable Care Act. Until we meet again on This Week in Accountable Care for Drs. Berger and Foxman, this is your moderator, Greg Masters, saying bye now.